proposal, I mean, to address that, which is from the moduli decay, and the fact is based on papers we have recently written with my collaborators at Texas A&M, Bhaskar Dutta and Kumar Sinha, who I think are collaborators and well known to some of the audience in this room. So this is the outline of the talk. After a brief introduction, I describe what is called the coincidence problem between baryon and dark matter. And then I focus on our proposal called cladogenesis. I will give you an explicit model, which for the kind of a baryogenesis part takes care of the situation kind of completely, and I'll close it up with summary and outlook. So this is the cosmic pie according to the observations. And we have so this is probably the biggest problem of all, but if you set that aside for the time being, there are two big problems to address. So one is this 4% of the baryonic matter. I mean, not that we don't know baryons, but why we have only baryons, we do not see appreciable amount of antibaryons. So this is basically the baryon asymmetry. I mean, matter-antimatter asymmetry, parameterized by eta b, and independently determined from BBN and CND. If you normalize that by the entropy density, is like order 10 to the minus 10. And secondly, the dark matter is 23 or so percent. And again, from the CNB, the normalized dark matter density, number density, should basically satisfy this relation. Because essentially what is pinned down by the CNB is the dark matter energy density, which is the number density times the mass, so that's why the mass goes down there. So of course one could say these are just initial conditions, but now with inflation being the dominant paradigm, I mean, this does not work because inflation dilutes everything exponentially away. So you really need to produce both of these things after inflation. So how we do that, as far as the baryon asymmetry is concerned, this is well known. So in this seminal, very short paper by Sakharov, there are three conditions if you want to get asymmetry from a symmetric initial condition. So the first one is, of course, baryon number violation. Without that, you cannot do anything. The second one is C and CP violation. And even though it's well known, I think it's worth mentioning because it is not unusual to see in many papers that they just mention C violation or CP violation and not both. And the reason is that the matter is basically fermions and they have both left and right chiral components. So if you have C violation, the number of left-handed fermions and number of left-handed antifermions will not be equal during the process, any process that violates C, and similarly for the right chiral components. But if C is violated, CP is conserved, then the left chiral fermions will be, we have the same number as the right chiral antifermions, and also if you just flip the indices. So if you find the total fermion number, which is left plus right, will be the same for fermions and antifermions. So you cannot generate a net baryon asymmetry. And similarly, if CP is violated only but not C, you will have a similar situation. So if you sum over the left and right chiral, then you get the same number for fermions and antifermions. So in order to really generate a net baryon asymmetry, you need to violate both C and CP. And so this is, the right necessary condition. And you also need out of equilibrium condition. That's, more or less clear, because if you start with a symmetric situation, you don't have any chemical potential, particle, antiparticle have the same, basically, occupation number. So you cannot get different number densities. And to really satisfy all the three in a successful manner, you need to go to beyond the standard model of particle physics. So there are many proposals. Electroweak baryogenesis doesn't work in the standard model. In the simplest MSSM cases, it's essentially almost ruled out. You can have affect dime baryogenesis. You get it from a kind of a condensate in the supersymmetric version of the standard model. You can have leptogenesis. Because it turns out that because of the electroweak scalarons, what matters is not just baryon number, but lepton number works well. So as long as you have non-zero B minus L, you are okay. You can generate any symmetry and so on. So the list goes on. But the standard picture is you have some kind of new heavy particle produced somehow, thermally or non-thermally, in the early universe. and then it decays in an out of equilibrium fashion such that PVC and CP are violated, and then you get innate asymmetry through the process. So there are many realizations, but this is the standard picture. So what about dark matter? So probably, I mean, the most popular and also extensively well-studied case is the Wing Miracle, which in which the relic abundance of dark matter is a product of a so-called thermal freeze-out process. Dark matter annihilation freezes out at some point. For kind of a weaker scale masses, couplings, the freeze-out temperature is about the 20th of the dark matter mass. And in order to really match the observed value for the dark matter energy density, the annihilation cross-section at the time of freeze-out should have this nominal value, which is about like 0.8 picobar. And this is again independent from the mass. So the thermal dark matter scenario works well, for example, for the Beano LSP, for S neutrino LSP, for lightest Caluso Klein particle, and so on. There are also non-thermal mechanisms for dark matter such that the relic abundance is not basically a product of a thermal freeze-out, but you produce dark matter particles non-thermally from some kind of late decay. And in that case, the late decay results in kind of an entropy generation and gives rise to a basically reheating temperature at late times, which is less than the thermal freeze-out temperature. And for example, this scenario works well if you have a Reno LSP or S neutrino LSP, and also you can produce gravitinos. Well, of course, you can also produce gravitinos from a scattering in a thermal bath, but I put it under non-thermal because, I mean, the process itself is not kind of like happening in thermal equilibrium because of the very weak coupling of the gravitinos. So the observation is that the dark matter energy density is something about like 6 times the ionic energy density. So the exact number probably doesn't matter. I mean, it could have been 2 or maybe 9. But what people usually call the coincidence is that, I mean, these are within the same order of magnitude. And the problem is that like these generally, I mean, come from two completely different sectors. So the processes involved to get you, I mean, to give dark matter and also to give baryon asymmetry, they are not, I mean, really directly connected. And then what people call the coincidence is like, why, I mean, these are within the same order of magnitude if the physics, I mean, are not the same or are not that much, I mean, kind of tied to each other. So now the question is that, is there a real issue here or we are just creating a problem in order to solve it? Because what's really important is not, I mean, just the prefactor here, whether it is 6 or what. The point is that these have the same equation of a state baryon and dark matter. They are both matter. So they redshift the same. So if this is 6 today, I mean, it was 6 at the time of Big Bang, I mean, it would be 6, I mean, billions of years from now. And this is very different in that sense from the dark energy, dark matter coincidence problem, which is the like why now. Because, I mean, they have different equation of the states, and so if this is like order 1 today, I mean, it would be very different later, and it was very different, I mean, early on. So for that reason, I mean, it makes sense to really call this a, I mean, true coincidence problem, but this does not stand at the same level. So this is just a ratio of like two quantities which redshift, I mean, similarly. Nevertheless, I mean, one can try, I mean, to come up with models that could give a prefactor which is, I mean, order like order 1 or order 10, I mean, if you will. And that's probably interesting more from a model building point of view. So what, I mean, what we may be able to do there. So as I just mentioned, the problem is that in general, the physics which is responsible for baryogenesis is different from the physics that govern dark matter production. So if we want to come up with a solution that gives like omega B and omega dark matter within the same order of magnitude, we should really, I mean, tie the two sectors first, somehow. And another important thing that even if we can do that, then this relationship basically relates to energy densities. It is completely independent of the dark matter mass, and we don't know the dark matter mass. So probably anybody has, I mean, his kind of own preferred model or preferred mass range, but we don't know that. And like observation, I mean, you can have like warm dark matter, like from a few keV all the way, I mean, to like ventilas, I mean, like several orders of magnitude, I mean, heavier. And if you want to relate the dark matter and baryon physics, eventually what microphysics will do for you is to relate the number densities, not the energy densities. So any solution, I mean, one can come up with will work only for a certain mass range, not for the kind of a whole mass range, which is at least allowed at the moment. So one can turn things around and say, I mean, if you come up with a model, then I mean, basically you predict a certain mass range within which the model works. So in that sense, I mean, the model can have a predictive power. And then, I mean, one can see whether that mass range, I mean, coincides with some mass range which is experimentally interesting. For example, if you are interested, like, in light dark matter and you take, like, Dama cohesion, these things, I mean, seriously, I mean, whether you can find a solution that come up with GV scale dark matter, or if, I mean, you are kind of happier with the conventional WIMP, like, dark matter, like, 100 GV, few hundred GV, whether you can come up with a solution that works, I mean, for that mass range and so on. But this...
So is this advantage, then, is that so much? You're saying you have a model which always predicts omega dark matters, so same order of magnitude as omega, or you're saying it predicts all possible value, and I'm going to use that as a way to reduce my parameter to minimize.
So what I'm saying is that omega dark matter is 6 times omega baryon. I mean,
but if
you want to translate it into relation between number densities, the mass appears.
Right. So if omega dark matter was 200 omega baryon,
right,
that will just change what your parameters are. So it's not a, then it's, you're not really, I guess, is it really a coincidence then, or is
yes,
using
I mean,
it as a measurement?
Yeah, that was my first point. I mean, so you should really take it with a grain of salt. So is it a real coincidence or not? But even then, if you want to come up with some explanation for that number, which seems to be 6, but would have been like, as you said, maybe 200 or maybe 0.1, then the point is that even if you want to explain that, you cannot really explain that independently from the mass. Because what microphysics does for you is like relating n number density of the dark matter to the number density of the baryon. Mm-hmm. So even then, I mean, basically, I mean, whatever you come up with will work for a certain mass range.
Can you somehow motivate the scale or predict the scale of your model that gives you the right mass?
Yeah, so I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, we call it a predictive kind of a model. So I mean, you can come up with a model that explains that for a certain kind of a mass range, and maybe, I mean, that mass range, I mean, is like something which can be probed like in experiments and is preferred by some experiments. So that would be something interesting. But the whole point is that, I mean, you cannot explain this all over the mass range, allowed mass range, obviously. So how to relate, I mean, the two sectors, the baryon, baryons and the dark matter. So there was this very actually interesting proposal by Dave Copeland in the early 90s, and that's called the asymmetric dark matter. And huge, I mean, a number of papers have appeared recently in the literature, but these are basically different realization of the same idea. So the idea is the asymmetric dark matter. And what happens is the following. So you introduce some conserved quantum number which is shared by both baryons and dark matter. So once that's done, then baryogenesis happens. So there are many mechanisms. So let's say baryogenesis happens through one of these mechanisms, and then you generate the baryon asymmetry. So you have baryon asymmetry, and then because the baryons, I mean, share one conserved number with the dark matter, that asymmetry will translate into some asymmetry in the dark matter sector. So for that reason, I mean, you should have, like, dark matter particles should also be kind of distinguishable from its antiparticle. So it cannot be, for example, like Majorana fermion. So you really need to have a difference between dark matter and anti-dark matter. And once, I mean, this dark matter asymmetry has also been created, then the dark matter annihilation happens, and somehow all of the symmetric part, similar to what happens in the baryons, for the baryons, all of the dark, the symmetric part annihilates completely, and then you are left with the asymmetric part. Yes?
So this issue of Dirac versus Majorana, it's up to a small mass splitting, right? Because you can always have a Dirac state, right? I mean, produce a small splitting, which is irrelevant to what scale.
Right.
Do
So the low energy points the God to Perkmedek, it's still the Mayaran.
Sorry, I couldn't understand.
Take a Dirac fermion, right? Make it as just a small splitting, right? It will be two Mayaran fermions, right? But if the splitting is small compared to anything, the energetic,
right,
all those states, it's as good as a Dirac fermion. But at very, very low energy, it could still be a Mayaran fermion.
Right.
So the dark matter could still be a Mayaran. We'll have a nearby state, okay?
Yeah. So actually, but what I meant was, like, I mean, to have, I mean, this model, I mean, to this proposal to have its kind of a whole glory, I mean, you really need a difference. But otherwise, you can always, I mean, that an annihilation happens such that the relic density is, I mean, like what you see. But in order to really see, I mean, like having the asymmetric part being left over the same as in the case of the baryons, you really need, I mean, some, I mean, distinction between particle and antiparticle. Otherwise, you are kind of like in the same kind of a thermal freeze-out scenario. So you freeze out all the way until, you annihilate all the way until it freezes out because of kind of a, like the rate drops below the expansion rate. So I don't know, I mean, whether...
What I'm saying is that the small split of, you know, Dirac fermion is equivalent to my fermion.
Oh, so you mean like some kind of a pseudo-Dirac, basically,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can still have something, I mean, which is probably, I mean...
which has low energy implications, because the ground state of the dark matter could still be a Mayaran fermion. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, you can have like... So you have like two mass states which are very close to each other, you mean, that's what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, similar like to an elastic dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that could help you, because, I mean, to do the annihilation, I mean, just like kind of the co-annihilation scenarios do that, yeah, exactly. And there are kind of various variants of the asymmetric dark matter. So, for example, one explicit model was the S-neutrino dark matter, like proposed by like these guys in 2004. And in this case, S-neutrino, I mean, carries lepton number, and lepton number is basically as good as baryon number for kind of a baryogenesis. So in that case, I mean, you have a relation between baryon asymmetry and the kind of a dark matter. Another one like was like a recent paper, and the mechanism coined as like hylogenesis. So what happens, I mean, it's very similar. Dark matter carries a baryon number, but dark matter basically lies in the hidden sector, and the baryons are in the kind of a visible sector. So you have some kind of a decay process, which gives you only kind of a like positive kind of a asymmetry in the observable sector. I mean, negative asymmetry, like equal amount opposite in sign in the hidden sector. So I mean, you have a symmetry, I mean, like between dark matter and anti-dark matter, and also baryon anti-baryon with opposite kind of the signs. And again, I mean, the asymmetric part annihilates away, and you will end up with some relic density. It's also exogenesis by Buckley and Randall, and they do it kind of in the reverse direction. So they first generate an asymmetry, like, so you have a kind of an X number carried by dark matter. So you generate an X asymmetry kind of a, like in the dark matter sector, and this X is also active under the scalaron, so that will be partially converted into baryon asymmetry and so on. So these are different realizations, but of the idea is just the asymmetric dark matter. And there are many more, I mean, you can find all kind of names, I mean, in the literature over the past year or so. I mean, like there was also this so-called thermal freezing and so on But the common issue is that you really need, I mean, in all of this kind of asymmetric dark materialization, you really need the symmetric part to completely annihilate. For the baryons, we know it happens because we know the baryon interactions. So since it is like order 10 to the minus 10, the asymmetry, then you can easily show that, I mean, baryon antibaryons annihilate, I mean, very efficiently, and I mean, that part is left. For the dark matter, I mean, it is not guaranteed because we don't know, I mean, the kind of the exact nature of the dark matter, its couplings and its interactions and so on. So you really need to guarantee that the asymmetric part of the dark matter completely annihilates. And in that sense, it will be a model-dependent thing. It is not kind of automatically related to the baryons. So, in other words, you need, I mean, to make sure that the annihilation cross-section is such that, I mean, it the symmetric part will annihilate all the bidding.
So you're not talking about loops here?
No. Well, I mean, I'm not convinced. Most kind of a popular beams, I mean, which are just like Majorana fermions, but they seem to, I mean.
Right, but the point of the loop is the cross section is small enough that they undergo thermal freeze-out, right?
Yeah. So my point is like that.
So
the thermal freeze-out must happen after, I mean, the symmetric part has completely gone. So I mean that basically the symmetric part should completely go away first,
right.
Just similar to baryons. And of course, I mean, notice that even if we somehow relate the kind of number densities through this asymmetric dark matter, it can naturally explain a situation such that the number density of the baryons and dark matter are like of the same order. And for that reason, basically, that works best if dark matter is also like a GeV scale, the mass, similar to the baryons. And perhaps, I mean, this mirror wall scenario, which is probably somehow neglected in the literature, is probably the most natural realization of this asymmetric dark matter, because in the mirror wall scenario, you have visible baryons, you have mirror baryons, and they interact weakly among between each other. So the point is like that the dark matter is nothing but kind of a mirror baryon, similar mass and so on. And now the question is that why, I mean, its number density turns out to be larger by a factor like of a few, I mean, than the baryon number density. And the point is that, so you need first to populate kind of the visible sector, the baryons, and then there is a weak interaction. So, I mean, it leaks a little bit to the mirror world. And then basically, I mean, the freeze out happens similar to the baryon freeze out in the kind of a mirror sector. And but the energy and therefore the Hubble expansion rate is basically dominated by the visible sector. And so, I mean, the rate, I mean, is somehow felt to be larger by the mirror sector. So, I mean, basically the freeze out there happens at a higher number density. So, I mean, just to get all the details correct, of course, you need, I mean, to just adjust the parameters, but the overall explanation seems to be rather natural, at least as far as the mass is concerned. Okay, so now let me move on to our proposal, which is called the cladogenesis. And the point is that if you really want to, like, if you really think, I mean, that there is a coincidence problem and also want to, like, explain that, the best thing is to come up with a single process that creates both baryons and the dark matter, or baryon asymmetry and dark matter. And in particular, it's preferable to have no further dark matter annihilation after it is produced, because once you have partial annihilation of the dark matter, after all, it all depends on the annihilation cross-section. And that is something which is not directly related to the baryons. So basically, the single process we consider is a moduli decay, and we call it a cladogenesis. Actually, Couvert suggested that because if you could, like, go, this is an evolutionary process in biology, such that you have a species, I mean, which branch and give you, I mean, a smaller kind of species. So this is basically, this process here is a cladogenesis. So that basically, justification was that we have a moduli, I mean, it partly decays to the baryons, it partly decays, I mean, to the dark matter, and then basically you have two things coming from a single source. But first, let me quickly, I mean, go through, I mean, what the moduli, I mean, do cosmologically. So these are basically scalar fields and acquire mass after supersymmetry is broken. If supersymmetry is exact, I mean, they are massless. These are just essentially like flat directions. And they are also gravitationally coupled to the matter, very weakly coupled. So the decay width of a modulus which has a mass n tau is given by this expression. So C is, of course, a number which depends on exact moduli couplings. So the problem with the moduli is that while at their true minimum, basically, they control the couplings of the theory, like the gauge couplings and so on. But in the early universe, especially during inflation, I mean, they can be displaced from the minimum by a very large value. And then that's very dangerous, because once they are displaced after inflation, or essentially after the time such that the Hubble rate drops below the mass, they start oscillating. And these oscillations behave like matter. And then if you, since they are also kind of a long-lived because of this M Planck in the denominator, then they can dominate the energy density of the universe when they decay. And when that happens, it means that basically they will reheat universe again. And the reheat temperature is given by this expression. And you see that for C, which is not extremely small, well, I mean, it will be even worse if it is smaller. But if you have a kind of a modulus of 100 TeV mass, roughly speaking, the reheat temperature is 5 MeV. And few MeV is basically the best that you can afford, because from BBN and then CMB, we know that kind of all three species of neutrinos, I mean, basically were in equilibrium. So it means that you really need the reheat temperature not to be below few MeV. Otherwise, the electrons and the muons and the tau neutrinos, I mean, could not have equilibrated. So if the mass is below 100 TeV, basically you ruin, I mean, the BBN. So your reheat temperature tends to be too low. Mass heavier 100 TeV is okay, in the sense that it will not ruin the BBN, but then it is also like dangerous in the sense that once you reheat the universe, you release entropy, so you dilute everything you had earlier, and the dilution factor, which I call by Y tau, is given by this expression. And this is the dilution factor. So even if you have like a moduli heavier than 100 TeV or so, then you see that you dilute everything by a huge factor. So even though the BBN will still be okay, but anything you produced earlier, including any baryon asymmetry or any dark matter via freezers or via any other mechanism that you like, will be diluted by a huge factor. And notice in particular that the reheat temperature that I showed you, like 5 MeV and above, is well below the electrophobic phase transition temperature and also the freeze-out temperature. So now there are two possibilities. So you produce the baryon asymmetry and dark matter before the moduli decay, which reheats the universe again. But then, I mean, you need to basically create number densities for those quantities which are like maybe 8 orders of magnitude or so above the observed value. So after the dilution, I mean, they are still doing okay. For the baryon asymmetry, this is probably not difficult, because actually there are some mechanisms like the Affleck line that give you very large kind of a baryon asymmetry, and the challenge there is to kind of dilute it. So this may be okay, but for dark matter, it seems to be much more, I mean, challenging to generate a dark matter like a, at least thermally, the dark matter abundance, which is like 10 to the 8 times larger than what we see today. And also notice, if somehow you have a model such that this one of these moduli is your inflaton, this option will not work, because nothing existed before the reheating by the modulus. The modulus was the inflaton. Okay? So, I mean, this option will not work if, I mean, somehow you have a kind of a moduli inflation. The second possibility is that the baryon asymmetry and dark matter, they are both produced after moduli decay. And in that sense, you can turn a handicap, which is the cosmological moduli problem, into a virtue. And it's important to notice that if you really want to do that, you need models of post-sphaleron baryogenesis, because the temperature is so low. So leptogenesis will not work. Anything which uses sphalerons will not work. So you really need to just create baryon asymmetry like directly, and also non-thermal dark matter, because the temperature is also way below the freeze-out temperature. So let's concentrate on this mass range times a few, of course, for the modulus somewhere between 100 and 1000 TeV. So about 1000 TeV is could be also phenomenologically interesting, because this is, I mean, where the modulus mass happens to be in the models of like anomaly and mirage mediation. If you want kind of a TeV scale masses for your supersymmetric partners of the quarks and leptons. And this is a generous range for the dilution factor that I choose, 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to the minus 7. So 10 to the minus 7 happens, so the number I showed you was like 5 times 10 to the minus 8, so 10 to the minus 7, I mean, it's easy to get. 10 to the minus 9 is more difficult, because you need that C, which shows up here, to be pretty small. Okay, so C, square root of C, basically appears in this expression for dilution factor. But I mean, you could basically imagine cases that can happen. For example, modulus such that you have volume suppression, such that what like happens, it's not the same thing, but what happens in the kind of large extra dimensions. So you have like a fundamental scale, like for the gravity, like which is kind of a diluted because of the kind of a large volume to much smaller thing. So here, I mean, you can imagine that the fundamental scale like is M Planck, but then, I mean, somehow you have a kind of a large volume kind of a model such that, I mean, what appears in the denominator would be much, much larger than M Planck, or equivalently, the C is very small. So let me just, I mean, stick with this range. On this end is probably, I mean, rather generous. So what happens after moduli decay? Moduli hits the universe, it produces all the particles. In particular, it will produce particles I denote by N, and these are those who are responsible for baryogenesis through their autoequilibrium decay. And it will also produce dark matter particles, which I call them chi, via chain decay. So dark matter, in order to be stable, I mean, you stabilize it by kind of assigning a symmetry. So you produce from the moduli decay all of the particles which have like, I mean, the same kind of a number under that symmetry. So if you're interested in SUSY, it will be kind of a R parity odd particles. And then, I mean, they will eventually all of them decay to the dark matter. Okay, so these two sets of particles will be, of course, produced from the moduli decay. And now, we don't want to have any annihilation of the dark matter. So anything, I mean, that is produced is purely from the decays. So what's the eta B or NB over S? So this will be the dilution factor, of course, times the branching ratio of producing N from moduli decay, times epsilon, and epsilon is a one-loop asymmetry factor in the decay of the N particle that creates baryonic symmetry. So this is well known. What about dark matter? So dark matter, we have this dilution factor which appears in front of any quantity, times the branching ratio to produce, if focusing, I mean, like on supersymmetry, R parity odd particles. So no further annihilation. So that's why the expression for dark matter will be so simple. I mean, you don't have any further kind of annihilations. Okay, so dilution factor somewhere between 10 to the minus 9 and 10 to the minus 7. The asymmetry is a one-loop factor, so even if all the couplings that appear there are order 1 and they are not constrained by phenomenology to be order 1, this is certainly less than 10 to the minus 1. So this is like something 1 over 8 pi times some combination of the couplings. Even if all the couplings are order 1, you get something like 1 over 8 pi anyways. So in the leptogenesis, for example, you get much smaller because those couplings are kind of a neutrino Yukawas, and the neutrino Yukawas, I mean, they are much smaller than 1, or at least some of them. But this is like bounded from above by something like 0.1. So here I'm just kind of making, I mean, qualitative and general arguments. And then, I mean, when I present the model, I'm going to kind of a more detailed, basically, discussion. So what about the branching ratio to produce, I mean, these N particles from moduli decay? So if you put these things together, according to this expression, you already come up with like some number between 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the minus 8. And your eta, observed value of eta is 10 to the minus 10. So in order to take the whole kind of a product to that level, you need a branching ratio for producing N, which is somewhere between 10 to the minus 2 and 1. But that's also, I mean, not difficult, I mean, to imagine. Because even like you have a kind of a scenario such that the moduli, I mean, decays democratically to everything, then you have like almost 200 degrees of freedom in the supersymmetric standard model. And if you add n is kind of a 1 degree of freedom, then it's not that difficult to think why, I mean, like a branching ratio of 10 to the minus 2 may appear. So it's just a general argument. I do not do anything like very specific at this point. So the bottom line is that the ballpark value for eta b can be naturally accommodated under, I mean, in general, general grounds in this scenario, okay? But of course, one need to really, I mean, what exactly this number is, I mean, would be dependent on the details of the model. What about the dark matter? So the dark matter relic density is that. And again, this is kind of a dilution factor. The branching ratio, interestingly, I mean, cannot be below 10 to the minus 3 to produce R parity odd particles. So let me.
Okay.
Yes.
Origins. Well, so you, the idea here is you're producing the n, and then n is, then it's standard. N is doing what?
N decays. N decays like according to the Sakharov's conditions.
And that's happening very quickly. So the temperature is like, so the reheating temperature is in UV, and then right away you get the baryon symmetry.
Yeah.
It's like, it's all just in...
It is so fast, yeah. I mean, basically, okay. It well happens, I mean, it all happens during, I mean, the time that everything decays to the lightest things, which will thermalize also.
So, it's in during the reheating.
Yes. So everything is kind of out of equilibrium, everything is non-thermal, so you don't need to worry about inverse decays and so on.
We have to assume that your gravitino is heavier than the model I think, right? Because if the model has to decay into a light gravitino,
I get to that point. So you so gravitino, I put it under kind of a, the category of R parity of particles. So you need, I mean, that, I mean, number of the gravitinos to be very small. For that reason, and also for the kind of a reason, I mean, to get the correct dark matter abundance. So I will get to that point. So roughly speaking, the branching for the kind of a gravitinos is like 10 to the minus 2. So the gravitino is also not very light, because my focus, I mean, like when I present a model, will be kind of a more on something which can happen kind of in the anomaly mirage mediation. So the gravitino is like 30 TeV or above, to be part, I mean, to be specific. So why the branching ratio, I mean, is larger than 10 to the minus 3? I'm focusing on the kind of a supersymmetric kind of a scenario. And as we will see later, I mean, typically you produce the gauge fields from the moduli decay mainly. And then, I mean, the worry will be like that you need to kind of have a small branching ratio for producing the gauginos, which are R parity odd. But it doesn't matter, I mean, how much you suppress this branching ratio for the two-body decay to the gauginos, the three-body decays will inevitably, I mean, occur. So this is, I mean, like how you get this 10 to the minus 3, and let me just... tell you. So, if this is your modulus, so let's say, I mean, you like, produce 8 particles, and somehow you want to suppress the gauginal production. So let's say, I mean, this is suppressed by a huge factor, you don't need to really worry about that. But once you have these, and you have like an abelian symmetry, which we have because of this standard model, then, I mean, we also get a two-body decay like that. So you cannot do anything about it. Once you have the two-body decay, then you just attach two kind of, let's say, gluino or gauginal ones, I mean, to one of them, you get that. And the ratio of these over this two-body decay to the gauge kind of fields. So this is a gauge coupling itself. So I mean, just based on the black phase case for three-body relative to the two-body and appearance of another kind of a factor of the gauge coupling, the ratio of this over this is something about like 1 over 500 or so. So no matter what you want to do at the level of the two-body, the branching ratio of order 10 to the minus 3 will happen to be around anyways. So, I mean, you cannot really, I mean, suppress it. Oh, you can suppress it, but it doesn't make sense, I mean, to suppress it because it will be kind of bounded from the below anyways. So, if I put a YT out from here, the branching, greater than 50 minus T from here, and if you want to see like this combination, whether it will be close to the value, which will explain the relic abundance, then you see that your dark matter mass should be somewhere between 5 GeV and 500 GeV. Which is good, because somehow you can like cover the lower end, which could be motivated if you take the kind of a sum of the experimental results seriously. And also it comfortably accommodates the more conventional WIMPs, like about 100 GeV or a few hundred GeV. But the necessity is that you need to suppress the two-body decays to R-parity odd particles. You need to suppress that, by at least kind of an order of magnitude or so. Okay? Depending on where exactly in the spectrum you are, you may need to suppress it by one order of magnitude or maybe by three orders of magnitude. So now the question is how to achieve that. So how to suppress the two-body decays to R-parity odd particles? This actually, dark matter, non-thermal dark matter without further annihilation, which requires suppression to R-parity odd particles, it was pointed out by Murray and Randall in their paper. So they considered this anomaly-mediated kind of a supersymmetry breaking scenario where they had Veno dark matter, and Veno cannot be a thermal dark matter, successful thermal dark matter candidate, because the annihilation cross-section is so large. So you need to produce that non-thermally. So it was suggested that you produce it via kind of a modular decay. And in order, again, to kind of avoid any further annihilation, you need to suppress the relic density from the moduli decay. So this was pointed out. But the point is that, you cannot do it, arbitrarily, because, again, you have this 10 to the minus 3 as a lower bound. So it doesn't make sense to talk about anything below that. So the dominant decay mode of the modulus is to the gauge boson final states. So let's see, generically how this happens. The coupling between the modulus and the gauge fields, it basically is governed by the gauge kinetic function, F. I have dropped the gauge indices, so this is actually F alpha beta, and you have alpha and beta here for a non-abelian case, but for simplicity I have dropped those. So this is the Lagrangian term, which couples the modulus to the gauge fields, and if you write it, then you will have a term like that. So this is the expectation value of the modulus, this is the modulus field itself, and C tau is a normalization factor which is given by that, such that your modulus has a normalized basically canonical kinetic characters. For example, if you are like interested in KLT type models, this C will be proportional to like inverse of the expectation value of tau, the modulus. Here I'm focusing on just a single modulus case. Let's say kind of volume modulus, for example. So if you take this Lagrangian term, then you can find the partial decay for the modulus to two gauge fields. And this is given by this expression, proportional to the third power of the modulus mass, as n is the number of gauge fields. So it's like 12. For the standard model. So, what about the gauginos? Because gauginos are the R-parity odd, so we want to suppress that. So this is how the modulus is coupled to the gauginos. So again, this is the gauge kinetic function. This is the kinetic terms for the gauginos. So you can see that a decay via this term will be mass suppressed by the Gaugino mass, because this is just like the, you can just use equation of motion for unshell particles. And then this will be suppressed by the modulus mass. And I'm considering, just to be in the context, so I'm considering something similar to kind of a mirage mediation. So eventually you have a modulus which is like maybe 1000 TeV or so, and you have a gravitino which is about 30 TeV. And all of the kind of supersymmetry breaking masses in the observable sector are like about a TeV or so. And since the decay to the gauge fields is proportional to the third power of the modulus mass, which is about 1000 TeV, then of course if this channel is suppressed by the Gaugino mass, which is about a TeV, then you can completely ignore it. It will be well below 10 to the minus 3. So this term is okay, you can completely drop it without any worries. But you also have another term, and this is the F term from the modulus. I mean, it's proximity written by the modulus, and this is the gauge connecting function. I take the derivative of the adjoint of that, conjugate of that, relative to the kind of the conjugate of the tau field, and this is the F term. So if you calculate the decay rate via this term, the decay rate will be something like that. This is the same as the gauge field. This is the same. This last part is also the same. But here I have the derivative of the F term, while for the gauge fields I had the expectation value of the modulus. So the decay to the gauginos will be suppressed if this expectation value of the kind of the derivative of the F term is much smaller than the expectation value of the modulus itself. This is actually, I mean, not likely to happen if you have just the kind of a complication in single modulus. So I think it's been shown, I mean, by some groups. However, it may be possible if you like have a complication with multiple moduli. For example, in this paper, they discussed like a Hayler moduli inflation, where like kind of a, one of the four volume kind of a moduli was inflaton. And I think, I mean, what they found is like that the decay to the gauginos, I mean, is suppressed in their case. So this is one example, but so I mean, it is, I mean, not a generic, but the point is like that, whether you can achieve that, because that's a necessity for this kind of a clavigenesis thing to work. Okay, but this is the condition you need to satisfy. In that case, you can not worry about the gauginos. But what about the other R parity odd particles? What about the gravitinos? So this is the relevant interaction term for the gravitinos. So G is the Taylor function, Taylor potential, superpotential, as usual, psi is the gravitino. So sigma is just like sigma mu nu thing, I mean, as the usual. And actually, I mean, you may remember, I mean, it was maybe about 2005 or so, there was a debate like about how important is the inflaton decay direct, I mean, inflaton decay to the gravitinos, because what most people focused before that was like thermal gravitino production, thermal gravitino problem. But then, I mean, of course, I mean, the gravitino can also be produced from the direct inflaton decay. And there was a kind of a, started by the kind of the Japanese groups, and how important that was. So for the gravitinos, you have to kind of distinguish between the helicity 3/2 and helicity 1/2 states. For the helicity 3/2, so as you can also see here, I mean, this piece, I mean, which is proportional to the gravitino mass appears. So for the helicity 3/2, basically the decay rate will be proportional to the modulus mass times the square of the gravitino mass. And if you are in a scenario like anomaly mediation, such that gravitino mass is like smaller than a modulus mass by almost a one Lu factor, then this will be very small compared with the decay rate when you have n tau to the third power. But now the problem is, for the helicity 1/2, if the modulus decays to the gravitino, the energy will be much, much larger than the gravitino mass. So you can just use the equivalence theorem. So you just basically use the Goldestino. And if you use the Goldestino, then the decay rate will be enhanced by a factor of energy over the mass squared. And that factor of 1 over gravitino mass squared will completely cancel this m3/2 squared here. And in that case, your decay rate to helicity 1/2 space of the gravitino, again, will be proportional to the third power on the modulus mass. So in principle, that could be worrying. Because this, I mean, may be comparable, I mean, to the decay to the gauge fields, which was like number of gauge fields divided by 128 pi. Fortunately, in this case, as you see, I mean, this phase space factor for the gravitino is something about like two orders of magnitude less than what you get for the decay to the gauge fields. Because for the gauge fields, it was like ng over 128 pi. Okay? So helicity 3/2, not important. Helicity 1/2 are also suppressed by at least like factor of 30 or so compared to the gauge fields. So far we have talked about the gauginos, we have talked about gravitinos. So the other R parity particles are like essentially the Higgsinos and also the S fermions. So what happens for them? Well, it turns out that fortunately you do not need to worry about S fermions at all, at least in the context of some kind of a mirrorized mediation models. And the reason is the following. The modulus is coupled to the S fermions, like S quarks and S leptons, I mean, through the gauge kinetic term. Sorry, through this Kähler potential, okay? So this is, I mean, how you do that. And what happens is that basically it happens, I mean, through the kind of a kinetic function, kinetic terms for the scalar fields. So this is basically the Kähler potential, and the derivatives of that will appear like in front of the kinetic terms of the scalar fields, the S fermions. So that, again, using the equation of motion, will be proportional to some power of the S fermion mass. So eventually the decay rate will be suppressed by the fourth power of S fermion to the modulus mass. And this is like, in the context of the model I discussed, or like the picture I discussed, it is like 1 TeV over 1,000 TeV to the fourth power, so completely, I mean, can be completely ignored.
So are they worrying about the S fermions because they were decayed up as well?
Yeah, because these are R parity odd. So I have to worry, but then, I mean, the decay will be suppressed, fortunately. Similarly, I mean, you can also have like a decay via the soft terms. So the same kind of terms that create the soft parameters for the scalar fields through the vacuum expectation value, they also couple the modulus to the S fermions. But here, I mean, the soft terms will be proportional, like the decay rate through that will be proportional to the fourth power of the gravitational mass over the modulus mass. This is also, I mean, completely suppressed. It's like 30 TeV over 1,000 TeV to the fourth power. So what about the decay to the Higgsians? So what is different here is that you need a coupling like that for chiral multiplets, the scalar components of that. But if you have a gauge invariant combination like HUHT, the two Higgses in the MSSM, or if you have a singlet, kind of a superfield, then, I mean, you do not need to have the conjugate here, and then you can just have like the gauge invariant combination there. So this is, I mean, for those of you, I mean, who are familiar, this is like basically along the line of this Giudice-Mascheroni mechanism, I mean, for the mu problem. So you can add a term like that to the Kähler potential that couples the, like tau to the Higgses, for example. So we are worried about Higgsians because those are R parity odd. And if you calculate again the relevant term for the decay through this channel, then you see that the decay rate will be proportional like to m tau cubed over m Planck squared. But again, similar to the Gaugenos, the derivative of the F term, I mean, will appear. So if you can suppress Gaugenos, then it is fair to say that you can also suppress the Higgsians. Okay? So this is more or less, I mean, a similar thing for the Gaugenos and the Higgsians. So now let me, okay, so quickly, okay, I'll try to be quick. Maybe I'll just give you, I mean, the most important things. So how to do, I mean, kind of a post-scalar and baryogenesis? Of course, we need new fields, we need baryon number violation, CP violation, C violation, everything. So the way we did it was like we added a singlet, a standard model singlet, or a set of them called N, a set of color triplets I call X and X bar. And so this is a mass term for the N fields, this is a mass term for the X and X bar fields. And since these are color triplets with opposite hypercharges, basically you need both of them to get a kind of a mass term. And basically we couple, I mean, the X bar to D-type quarks, the down-type quarks, and X and N to the up-type quarks. But in this case, we want the R parity to be conserved because we want to have a stable LSP as a dark matter. And this looks somehow very similar to the kind of R parity violating cases with UDD, but we don't want a UDD because we don't want R parity violation, so we add a kind of a new color triplet with the proper kind of R parity assignments. So the scalar components of X and X bar are R parity odd, and the fermion component of N, are R parity even, and the fermion component of N is R parity even, such that the R parity is overall conserved. And now what happens is that if you can have the baryogenesis from either the decay of X and X4 or from the decay of Ns. And this is like a similar kind of, this is a standard null scenario from now on. So you need at least to have two kind of a decaying fields in order to get a CPA symmetry and so on.
Just a question. So would the decay of, would the exchange of X generate any variable changing couples?
Yeah, so actually, I mean, this will lead to kind of a neutron anti-neutron oscillation. But basically, even if you have like couplings of
order. So you have like one. Oh, this also.
Oh, this one itself. No. Yeah. This is a like baryon number. Yeah. This is a baryon. These do not have kind of any baryon number themselves, x and x bar. So the baryon number comes from
the first term, if you would erase m, then the model would go
down. If I.
And if in the first term, if you would erase m, the model would go down.
Yeah. So there are kind of a different ways to produce baryon asymmetry here. But if I want to keep in mind that the R parity odd particle production needs to be suppressed in order to address the dark matter kind of a part of the scenario, then this will be basically the only channel through that you can generate baryon asymmetry. And what happens is the following. You produce the fermionic component of N, which are R parity even, and that's OK. And then, I mean, they can decay to uptight quark and an X. So this is the 3-level. These are, again, the standard, like the vertex correction and self-energy correction. So you need them with on-shell particles in the loops in order to get the CPA symmetry. And again, the calculation is rather standard. So the decay of N alpha, alpha maybe, the minimum number you need is like 2 alpha equal 1 and 2, I mean, in order to get a baryon asymmetry at the end of the day. Epsilon alpha will be equal to this. So this is again like, these are all kind of the standard expressions. So if you choose all of the lambdas, so the lambdas here are matrices, okay? I mean, I have omitted all the kind of indices for simplicity. If all of the individual couplings are order 1, and you have CP violating phases are order 1, and it turns out in this case everything will still be compatible, I mean, with all phenomenological bounds if while CP violating phases are order 1 and the magnitude of the couplings are order 1, then you see that the imaginary part will also be like order 1, and your epsilon will be like somewhere between 0.1 and 0.01, so order 0.1, okay? And if, I mean, there is no constraint from phenomenology, it is more natural to think all the couplings are basically order 1, because it's not constrained. So what about, so how you produce, okay, so I can probably skip that. I mean, in the interest of time, but I can tell you later, I mean, if you, the point is that, I mean, the branching ratio between 10 to the minus 2 and 1 for the n particles, I mean, you can get. So this will be, I mean, the way, I mean, you produce them. So some of the phenomenological and cosmological considerations for this model. You have baryon number violation. So naturally, you can get a neutron anti-neutron oscillation. And the current bound like is like 10 to the 8 seconds. And then even if all the couplings are order 1 that I showed you before, basically, if you found a appropriate operator for neutron anti-neutron oscillations, that will be in agreement with the current bound. So there is no problem with this part. Of course, I mean, there will be also like contributions to the B and K mixings. And the reason is that you have the DD coupling, and because those come with kind of different colors, they cannot be of the same anti-symmetric combination, so they cannot be of the same flavor. So you will have kind of a flavor mixing, I mean, K and D mixings. These, however, will happen at one loop, and again, I mean, everything will be okay, I mean, phenomenologically. So this is discussed in the paper. I just skip, I mean, all the details. You have some new R parity odd and even color triplets. You remember X and X bar? So you have both R parity and even and R parity odd ones, and these can be basically probed at the LHC if they are kind of order TEV. And finally, since I'm discussing the non-thermal dark matter, then VINO will be a natural dark matter candidate in this case. And in the scenario, we wanted to avoid any annihilation after production of R parity odd particles, such that everything is just like coming directly from the decay. I mean, no further annihilation, such that you need to care about the annihilation cross-section. And it turns that even if your annihilation cross-section is like about 3,000 picobar, which is like, what's that? Like, I think, I mean, this was considered maybe to address like Pamela and so on, I mean, something in that range. But even if it is like as large as 3,000 picobar, at those lower heat temperatures, you would not have, I mean, any annihilation basically happening. Okay? So obviously, I mean, the 0.8 should be completely okay. So now quickly, I mean, the summary and outlook. So what I tried, I mean, to convey is that even if you really think, I mean, there is an issue to address, like the coincidence between baryon and dark matter, you really need to connect the physics of the baryogenesis and the dark matter somehow together. Otherwise, it will be just adjusting things, I mean, not addressing things. And in that respect, a non-thermal scenario seems to be more fit to do that, such that everything just comes from a single kind of a process, which could be a decay process. In particular, the late-time module, I mean, could produce a common source. In that case, we will have a process stellar baryogenesis and a non-thermal dark matter. And the main parameter that governs, that controls the asymmetry, baryon asymmetry, and the dark matter abundance is essentially the dilution factor. Baryon asymmetry, I mean, I showed, I mean, the ballpark value you can get without, I mean, like, much effort or doing, I mean, really any real tricks. The dark matter, I mean, you need, I mean, to somehow suppress the decay, the two-body decay to the R parity of particles, and in that case, you can, like, get the correct abundance within this mass range. So finally, I mean, I showed an explicit model for the baryogenesis. So explicit model with suppressed two-body decays when everything is taken into account properly, like all of the kind of stabilization schemes and also like predictions for supersymmetry breaking masses and so on, such that you also naturally suppress the decay to the R parity of particles. So I mean, that can be thought, I mean, like doable. As I mentioned, because I mean the different combinations have appeared, like for the decay to the gauge and gauge inverse, and also I mentioned on one paper. But this, I mean, definitely needs a more detailed investigation, and that's the kind of work under progress. Okay, so thank you for your time. Yes.
Oh, of course. That's a neat model. I just want to ask you about this. So if you think just a standard wave, right, and you start varying the I don't know, fix the couplings, vary the mass, right, you vary annihilation cross section, and you vary it to the point where you agree and that's the tuning. But you also have a tuning, don't you? Like you have the range from 5 to 5 N. If I fix everything and I start varying that mass, I will be also either overproducing or underproducing the dark matter. Right? So at some point, I don't see why is this conceptually different from the wave picture, where you know it's the same tuning.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, this can be like looked at. I mean, like in two ways. So one is like from what you say. So let's say somehow you measure the dark matter mass. In that sense, I mean, you know where you are exactly in the range. And then how much you need to suppress, you definitely then need to come up with. So you need, I mean, to arrange for that. But another thing is like to look, I mean, like for more from the theoretical point of view, see, I mean, a complete and successful model, in a complete and successful model, by how much, I mean, you can get kind of a suppression of two body decays. And then that will give you a kind of a prediction for a dark matter mass. If the dark matter mass comes, I mean, close to that value, then you could say, I have a kind of a reasonable model. If not, then you could say, okay, I mean, just like any other models, I also need, again, to arrange, I mean, that once, I mean, the dark matter mass is found, exactly.
But on the outset, if I fix all the gauge couplings and start varying the mass of the dark matter, I have a very similar issue here in your model and in the model of standard wind annihilation, right? Just you have to, in there, you have to tune the cross section. Here you have to probably tune the fraction of energy that goes into the dark matter out.
No, I mean, in that sense, I agree with you. But again, I mean, the point is like that whether you could like do it in the reverse direction. So you could make a prediction. And I'm not sure whether that's something natural in the context of these annihilations. Because I mean, I don't know whether, I mean, anything is really preferred.
Well, then I would be much happier if you'd say, okay, I have a model and the mass of Dark Matter is equal to this.
Yeah, so
and
that's...
Then you can argue, okay, then I improve that one.
But what I mentioned as kind of a work in progress. Because first, I mean, one really needs to know, like, what kind of suppression you can accommodate naturally. If you can do that, then, I mean, you can, like, say, okay...
So you think that this 5 to 500 is a natural habitat, but if you work harder, you just narrow it in.
That's the direction.
Who's base here through Thursday?
Tomorrow.
Oh, just for Friday.